Hello and welcome to the Poetry Pause, a poetry podcast brought to you from a cowshed in West Wales. Welcome. In this episode, we're looking at Seamus Heaney, wonderful Irish poet. I'd like to welcome Emma. Emma, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Really pleased to be back here.
After lockdown. Christian Donovan, who's been a guest before, and she was so brilliant, we had to have her back. So, Christian, how are you?
Fine, and it's lovely to be out in the countryside once again after so long being just my own company.
So, while you can't divorce a poet from his background, in this episode we're going to zoom in on what he brought to poetry mainly, with perhaps a future episode going into the political context. I think he himself said that politics and history were, he saw them as inextricably linked, didn't he? Mm. And he has written some very amazing poems about it, but we'll stack those for now. So, Christian, what poem have you brought, please, and why did you choose it?
Well, this is a poem called Human Chain. It's the title poem in his final collection of poems, which was called Human Chain. I chose it because it resonated with me so much at the moment with the situation in Yemen and in other places that we've seen so often the United Nations stepping in and providing food for people who are starving through no fault of their own. And this seemed to me that it just summed this all up, the fact that we watch on television people being given the very basics of life. Human Chain, for Terence Brown. Seeing the bags of meal passed hand to hand in close-up by the aid workers and soldiers firing over the mob, I was braced again with a grip on two sack corners, two packed wads of grain I'd worked to lugs to give me purchase, ready for the heave. The eye to eye, one, two, upswing, onto the trailer. Then the stoop and drag and drain of the next lift. Nothing surpassed that quick unburdening. Backbreak's truest payback. A letting go which will not come again. Or it will. Once. And for all.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we know anything about the person that the poem was written for?
The only thing I know about him was that he was a colleague in the teaching world, a colleague of Seamus Heaney. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, he wrote quite a few tribute poems, didn't he, to different people? Mm. So, Emma, what's your take on this poem?
I find this a very intriguing poem. The way it focuses in on two people or a chain of people and their experience, what they see, how the hands, the lugs, when there's such a huge subject going on around it. And I think that's the strength of the poem, the way it hones in on the identifiable human interaction and a simple action. Yeah, it feels very real and kind of pins down something that is unpindownable.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I just happened to read this morning in one of the papers from Rachel Whiteread, who's a sculptor. She talked about poetry being words touching each other. And at those lines, is it one, two, upswing? Mm. And then there's a contrast, isn't there, into the verbs in the next line. What are those?
The stoop and drag and drain.
Yeah, that you can hear the movement, can't you? You can see the movement. It's incredibly evocative use of words, really.
But that's Seamus Heaney's strength, isn't it? The use of words. And also, you know that he has actually done this, right? He probably wasn't feeding people with the United Nations, but he was doing it on the farm as a young boy.
Yes.
And he knew exactly this particular action and manages to convey it to us. I think that's the strength of his poem.
Yes.
It's a physical weight as well, that kind of weighs down and makes very clear the weight of the larger subject, you know, the heaviness on all of us because of this situation.
What did you make of the last line? What are the last lines?
Or it will, once and for all.
Did you think that was about death?
Well, I didn't to begin with. It puzzled me for a while. Then eventually I read something which guided me in that direction. But Emma, you thought about it straight away.
Obviously, it's about letting go of the weight, the sack, and having back break. But also the relief of it, the letting go of a breath or, of your life, really.
Yes, your last gasp.
And it's the thing that ties us all together, for all of us, you know, no matter your situation in life.
I thought it was about a surrender, really, to that every and everybody has to.
It's the great leveller, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. I'm always interested in how poets break through in terms of getting their work known. And I think what you were talking about, this is work that he really knows, that he's really done, is what partially accounts for his popularity, I think. Because it must have been such a new voice at the time. And there's a poem he's written, I think it's about a forge, where you've no doubt at all this is not somebody who sort of visited a forge once. This is a thing that he's very familiar with. So, yeah, his thing is this. How did you describe it, Christian, in terms of the use of language?
Well, I think the thing is he goes into such depth of knowledge of his subject. He uses words that perhaps we don't use at all nowadays. But we don't have to rush to a dictionary or Google or whatever it is to look them up, because the way he describes whatever it is in his poem with words that we don't know, but it's quite plain what they mean. And I think that's what people really appreciate is the old-fashioned words, but they have such resonance in the way he puts them in his poems.
Yes, and he's a marvellous reader of his own work, isn't he?
Digging. The cold smell of potato mould. The squelch and slap of soggy peat. The curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Those words are really used as tools, aren't they? So should we talk a bit about his life now and then a bit more about his contribution, and then we'll have our responses to him. So what do we know about him that we think is important?
Well, he was born at the outbreak of war in 1939, just before, a few months before the war started, in a very rural setting in County Derry in Northern Ireland. Brought up on a farm, he was the eldest of nine children, so it was quite a crowded existence, one imagines. But at the age of 12, he won a scholarship to a Catholic boarding school, because they were a Catholic family, to a Catholic boarding school in Derry. So this was a parting from his home life, and was, he always said, it was the start of the leaving of the rural to the joy of education, though that obviously he loved the rural as well.
Mm-hmm. Anything else notable from that, do you think, Emma, that sticks out for you?
What stood out for me was the death of his younger brother. I think that he wrote a few poems around that topic, and the sense of that he wasn't there, he was at school when it happened. 4-year-old brother got hit by a car. And I think that sense of being rooted to home and to family, and a sense of being somewhere else, is something that continues throughout his work.
Yes.
The kind of, it's not quite a tension, but it's there, it's underlying. Yeah. The two senses of him as somebody who lives in a rural community with closely knit family, and the kind of man of letters that we discussed before. So
sort of parallel lives, really, aren't they? You know, it's very interesting. I mean, he went on to achieve, his first book was Death of a Naturalist, wasn't it, which was published to great acclaim and won awards. And then he published 12 big collections, all with Faber. And that includes his poem Digging. Billy Collins said this was a poem where he said he found his voice, that he believed only Seamus Heaney could have written Digging. And it does combine those two aspects that you just mentioned, I think.
He himself recognised conflict, a lot of conflict inside himself, which started, he said, from home, where his father was a cattle dealer, a farmer, and didn't say much. His mother was from a more, if you like, industrial background and did all the talking. So there was that conflict of peace and quiet and perhaps noise. And then the neighbours, they were a big Catholic family, the Heaneys, and their neighbours, quite a few were Protestants, and obviously they were friends and colleagues in the farming community. And then, as you say, being sent away from home and having to be independent, and then going to university in Belfast, so that he was in a big city, really, from the age of 12 in Derry and then in Belfast, that he found a lot of conflict within himself. And he recognised that as where his poetry came from, were all these different tensions in himself.
Yes.
But I don't think that his poetry is tense in any way. If we take Digging as the example, it's a gentle look at difference, but it's nuanced as well. You know, it's an acceptance of difference. And in that way, a lot of his poetry seems very healing and brings things together. It's not angry necessarily.
No, but did he recognises that there's something different inside him.
Yes.
And that draws out what he wants to write.
Yeah. I mean, Digging has got such universal truth, I think, hasn't it, in terms of it's an appreciation of what his father did in terms of really hard manual slog, but also an understanding that what he's got in his, is it squat thumb, is a pen, and that's going to be his weapon. So it's how...
But both are equally justified.
Yes. No, it's fascinating. So he won 18 awards, including the 1995 Nobel Prize for Literature, which he described to friends as the N thing. Yeah. And I think that's very endearing. You know, he sounds like he was a modest man, doesn't he? He couldn't quite bring himself to say that he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he moved to Southern Ireland in 1972 to Glanmore with his wife, Mari, who was also a writer and a teacher, wasn't she? And they had three children. When he died, RTE broadcasted the funeral on radio, and I think there was a 3-minute silence at Dublin's football ground, because he was a big football man and he was so beloved. And I read somewhere that at one point, I think it was around about 2006, something like 2/3 of the poetry books.
I think that was when he was 70. But 2/3 of the poetry collections sold in Britain
were by Seamus Heaney. Yeah.
By Seamus Heaney.
Incredible.
That's not just that's probably not in Ireland. It's in...
Yeah.
You know, what was a... And he was careful to point it out, an almost foreign country.
Yes. Yeah. He was a massive poetry rock star, wasn't he? Now, why was he such a poetry rock star? We've talked about, in a way, he used language in quite a traditional poetry way, didn't he? There's rhythm, alliteration, onomatopoeia, things like that. The words are very visceral, I think.
Yes.
The subject matter, presumably, was new and fresh for people.
I'm not sure. I think it may come from a kind of tradition of Thomas Hardy and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's very much there. He's almost in the soil, in the peat that he writes about. It, in that sense, it's very, like you say, visceral. Yeah, it bridges that gap between being very learned and academic, but also being in amongst it, experiencing things. He's not an observer, he's right there in it.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
And I mean, although he started off with being influenced by classical poets like Gerard Manley Hopkins and Wordsworth and Yeats particularly. He was completely different and went his own path. And he didn't write necessarily all in rhyme, but sometimes he used rhyme. Yeah. And he devised his own poetry way of doing things.
He was very influenced by Ted Hughes as well, I think.
Yes, indeed. I've got a book floating around here called The Rattlebag from 1982, which was my sort of first introduction to poetry. And it's edited by Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes. It's a fantastic collection. There's lots of folk poetry in there. It was an amazing introduction to poetry. So, yeah, and I suppose, were they friends, Ted Hughes and him?
I think so, yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about him, I think, is that he was in groups of poets, wasn't he? He joined a group of poets at Belfast, and then later on he joined the Field Day Collective.
Yeah, Fieldwork, yeah. He launched that, didn't he, with a group of people in Northern Ireland, particularly to try and draw out Irish culture in Northern Ireland. So it covered not just writing, but also plays and other cultural events. And he wrote a drama for them specifically.
Yes, yes. Stephen Ray was involved, the actor, wasn't he? And Tom Paulin, who was a literary critic.
And Friel as well.
Brian Friel. Yes. Mm. So that collective seemed to go on for quite a long time, actually.
Yeah, I think so.
So
it's interesting that, because it's communal, isn't it? It's like the thought of poets sat on their own somewhere, kind of torturing over things, rather than a community of, like we're doing now, discussing and sharing thoughts and ideas. Because he also says that the completely solitary self, that's where poetry comes from. So it's it's another, not tension, but another opposition in a way, the two things.
Yeah, kind of contradiction.
Yeah.
I mean, I think all great art and creativity comes from a contradiction, actually, you know. Mm. And we should be quite worried as creatives if we feel like utterly happy bunnies, because it might mean that we haven't got any itches to scratch.
Yeah, what's to write about?
Yes, yeah. So could Seamus Heaney only be Irish?
He was quintessentially Irish, but there could be other people like him from other, you can imagine, a rural English, rural Welsh person producing poetry.
I get a sense of Celticness from him. You know, just if we compare him again to Ted Hughes, there's a kind of certainty and aggression that doesn't come from the Celtic nations. I don't feel like his way of writing nature is quite different to Ted Hughes's. It's more nuanced and dug into the ground in some way.
Yes. I mean, he wrote those bog poems, didn't he? Which I've read one of them about Tolland Man, I think. Yeah. They were about bodies found in Jutland. But, you know, we're recording this in fields, and I kind of think about, I should do some mud poems.
Yeah.
Because many times I think, my goodness, my life is mired in mud. I don't mind that, but you can't get away from it.
In the estuary too, you would have the estuarial mud.
Yes.
You know, which covers a multitude of sins, I'm sure.
Yes.
Down there.
Yeah. It's the sort of opposite of the kind of Country Living magazine. Yeah. pretty rural life, isn't it? This is blood and guts. And there is a lot about death in his poems, I think. So, and you wonder about that. Obviously, he was living through the Troubles. He was Catholic. How did he kind of negotiate his role as, almost a cultural icon with his religion and political causes? What do we know about that, or think about that? Because he wasn't a spokesman for republicanism, was he?
He didn't want to be. He wanted to write about what he saw and what he felt, but not actually to be leading any kind of movement other than a poetic one.
Mm-hmm. And he was asked to be poet laureate, wasn't he, in Britain, and turned it down.
Was that the occasion when he wrote the letter saying that he was never British but always Irish?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he's very clear throughout that where he's from and what his personal belief system is. But, you know, he said poetry doesn't function well as exposure and accusation. That's not what he wanted his work to be.
No, he didn't want it to be sort of polemical or no. politically polemical. Mm. I mean, there is an amazing poem, isn't there, about a young woman who's been tarred and feathered for adultery, which is you know, gosh.
Well, particularly with a British soldier. Yeah. I think that was it.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't let us off the hook on it.
No.
But I think he's very much, you know, he speaks a lot about living with it every day. It's not mythologized by an outside observer. It's, yeah. you know, it's again, it's nuanced. He gets along with his neighbours who are Protestants. It's a different experience for the people living it day to day than it is for people looking in from the outside.
Yeah. Shall we do our responses now? Mm-hmm. And I think you should kick off, Christian, as lead Heaneyite.
The show goes on. An actor, Walid Rashid, tours puppet shows to bombed Syrian villages. Listening to the children's chirrups as they assemble on stumps of their disintegrated school, I can ignore the rubble's torture on my knees behind the old door, which doubles as my showman's booth. Lit by the sun's unsubtle rays, the backdrop was sculpted by Assad's Air Force. Beside me, in order of appearance, a flock pile of characters gape. I peep front of house, glove and raise my hands to the window stage to start my drama in miniature. A shh chases the chatter across no man's land to stir collywobbles in my belly. My audience foresees the plot. Mr. Punch clobbers Judy, the baby, Toby the dog, Joey the clown, the crocodile and all other comers. Giggles crescendo. In this dust, laughter wins wars.
Lovely. Thank you. What do you reckon, Emma?
I love this poem and I can see how it's influenced by Human Chain. These people become of central importance and the bombing and the larger political issues are put aside for a moment. And it's just a kindness, sharing the art and the entertainment to spread joy and ease tension. And it's just got the most beautiful last line.
Yeah, that last line is wonderful. We must hear it again. Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that you've chosen to do it as the character, so you're writing in the first person, because I think it makes it really show, not tell, very strongly. And also, it is such a universal truth that people will be cultural in terrible circumstances. Yeah. And to have kids doing it is just, it's a wonderful poem, I think. It's really inspired. Yeah, it's great. And what give us our last line again, please.
Giggles crescendo. In this dust, laughter wins wars.
So what inspired you to write that along with Human Chain?
Well, it was a picture I picked up out of The Guardian, I think, which showed this man, Walid Rashid, with his little theatre, which basically was just an old front door with the window cut out. And he was crouched behind in this bomb site. And the children in that harsh sunlight were just gathered around, as children do, and obviously laughing at what was going on. I then found that, in fact, Punch and Judy are universal across Europe and across Arab territory as well, right into Eastern Europe. So it seemed that it would fit with something that we knew about, that we'd all experienced in happy times on the beach or whatever, Punch and Judy. So, yes, that was it. And the fact that it did relate in a way to that feeling of having to help out, the in Human Chain, the helping out with the United Nations and the aid workers in amongst the violence of those men in Human Chain, the guns of the soldiers, which were still going off over the heads of the people who needed feeding. Mm. Well, these children were in the same situation. Mm. They needed entertainment, didn't they?
Yeah, it's very apposite for Syria, isn't it? Gosh. Great. Thank you, Christian. Emma?
Propel. Progress is an elbow, a gawky, awkward hinge extended. It is pointed but forgives. It's a crook to cradle the world on fire, carries our burden headlocked at its Celadon. It is thuggish, angles to be singular, only flexes one way. But bone, muscle, sinew, skin lifts heavy. Let the layers give, bruise. Let our handles cut in, catch the fallen falling further, scattered provisions from this broken human chain. Soften your surge, meld links to connection. Arm to a curve where time scoops, hooks, huddles as a broken wing. Loosen for a second. Listen to the joint creaks mending to a nudge. Pivot as it reaches on.
Great, thank you. What do we reckon, Christian?
Well, first of all, it is amazingly Seamus-y, if you could call it that.
Seamus.
Not shameless.
Seamus-y.
It's shamelessly Seamus-y. It is beautiful with so much alliteration. It follows the verse pattern that he was so fond of, the tercets, the three lines in each stanza. I just was blown away by this, really, and the feeling that the poet is so close to his subject, or her subject in your case, but Seamus always seemed to be right there, and you are definitely right there with this elbow. But I also, beyond that, thought that it was a really good poem that was good for this time. At the moment, we all need each other's elbows, elbows which support other people, elbows which provide that hug that we're all so desperate to have. And it really sang to me in that way. So, yes, I love it.
Yeah, it's very clever to zoom in on an elbow like this. Mm. It's a wonderful poem to listen to, I think. And I love how you've picked up on the sort of broken human chain. Mm. And I felt, because I think it's really a poem that you respond to through feelings by listening, that there was hope for this human chain by the end of it. Mm. But yeah, no, it's fantastic. Tell us more about the inspiration.
When I had to kind of respond to Seamus Heaney, it just seemed like an overwhelming thing to do. I just couldn't get to grips with it. And I think Human Chain, like we've been discussing, it really zooms in on humanity in the time of crisis or a wider political thing. And so I took the kind of, I zoomed right out and I took progress as a kind of abstract noun, and I thought, right, how can I make this bodily? How can I push myself into it? And again, thinking about nuance, you know, it can be a crook and a hug, but it can also nudge you out of the way. And, you know, I tried to look at it from all of those different angles, and this is what came out.
Yeah, to make it a really physical thing is a very good idea, isn't it? Great. Yeah, thank you. Excellent. Okay.
Can we hear yours, Pippa?
Yeah, mine is very small, and I want to spend more time with Seamus Heaney, definitely. And I would like to write a mud poem, I think. But this was all I could come up with now. I didn't feel I did it very adequately, but I just went small and local and to what was happening to me currently, so in a rural setting. So here we go. That's not an excuse, really, but just a sort of explanation. Lecture. Hearing my small friend speak, he tells of crown of thorns starfish and wolf spiders. He says he does not think I am clear on what arachnids are. We sit in Ivor Wood on old tree stump. Rowan is five. We watch the dog, the stream, the light fragments through leaves. Small boy to old woman, things forgot or never learnt. And all round and surround sound, those birds insist it is spring. So, a small offering. What do you think?
I think it's lovely that it's so close to nature and very minutely observed, and this the wisdom of a five-year-old comes through so well that his voice, that you're not clear on what arachnids are. You think, yes, it could only come from that child who's just learnt what an arachnid is,
yes,
himself.
Yes.
But I love the sounds, which were very Seamus. The line "all round in surround sound" is gorgeous. Really, good. Really nice.
Thank you.
I disagree with you calling this a small poem. Mm-hmm. This made me very emotional when I read it, because it's so clear. It's such a pure image. If you added mud to this, it would be ruined. And that one line, "he does not think I am clear on what arachnids are," that's such a simple truth. We know in that one line exactly who these two people are and the relationship between them. And, you know, the birds insisting it is spring. The outer world is impinging on this minute in some way. It's a very pure poem, and I wouldn't change anything about it.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, I have to say, I got a lot of small boy out of reading Seamus. I mean, there are poems about him, especially the one about his brother's funeral and things, where you feel that young lad is very alive in the spirit of the writing, don't you?
Yeah.
So, great. Thank you. He there's a book of interviews with a chap called Dennis Driscoll. It's called The Stepping Stones. And it's a remarkable book. It's very entertaining. I got it on Kindle. But he asks him very direct questions, for instance, about his Catholicism, whether he was still a Catholic. And he says that Catholicism provided a totally structured reading of the mortal condition, which I've never quite deconstructed. Mm-hmm. So we're back here, really, about Catholicism with creating out of his contradiction. But he also talks a little bit, which, you know, I'm particularly interested in, about himself as being Jungian in religion, because Jung was all about the shadow side, you know. On the one side, you've got the sort of light side of us. Again, you know, it is the psychological theory of contradiction. That poetic imagination offered a world of the light and a world of the dark, a shadow region. And not so much an afterlife, but an afterimage of life, you know. So it's always a little bit at a distance. And the quote I like from him is, "For years I've been writing poems where I meet ghosts and shades. They are the ones I like and value most." And then he goes on to talk about a poem called Casualty, The Tolmount Man, which is about the... and District and Circle, which is about going round and round on the tube, but lots of other things as well. So he was highly self-aware, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yes, I think that's a good description of what he was. And I don't think he would have been a very satisfactory poet laureate, do you? Where you've got to trot out a poem on a particular event at the drop of a hat. And somehow I feel that, and I don't know if this is true, but that he probably thought about his poems for a very long time before they saw the light of day.
Yes.
And that he wrote what he wanted to write rather than what he was told to write. But I think, like great artists, I mean, he did have phases, didn't he? So he started off with writing about what he knew, which was the farm and the rural life. But then once he became more politically aware, then he was writing the bog poems and describing Ireland. And in between, then he had his wonderful love poems for his domestic life and also his love for Ireland. So, yes, I think that... He wrote what he wanted to write, but obviously at different times of his life, there were different priorities.
Yeah, so his own man, really, yeah.
I think when his work is very spare, even in digging, where there is a little bit of the gravelly, that kind of thing, and the slopping and slapping of the earth. He's writing in one way, and then when he is among the bog people, there are more words because it's deep and dark and slimy, and there's more language to be used.
Yes.
I think he's selective about what language he uses according to what he wants to convey. And sometimes there's a purity and clarity of image, and sometimes it's a bit more squishy.
Yes. That is a good word, squishy. Yeah. I mean, he manages to be a man of letters without being in the slightest bit pretentious, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Mm.
There is, it may be an apocryphal story, but you probably read it too, that when he was on his deathbed, he was in a hospital in Dublin, he texted his wife,
Latin,
Sumere, don't be afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
The poem that really sticks with me and kind of sums him up for me is the one where he talks about driving through, I think it's France and Italy, and he's kind of longing for the ordinariness of his wife. And, you know, some people could be totally insulted if this great poet writes about your ordinariness, but it's just his actual life that means the most to him.
Yes.
And I find that
very
interesting.
Yeah, it's very... This Dennis Driscoll, the interviews, they end with a discussion of different funerals, which is just fantastic. I think it is very Irish, very Catholic. And it's about sort of different poets' funerals. How did they go? And then they discuss options for Seamus's funeral. What church might he use, and how many people might have attending and everything. And it's, they're having great crack discussing these funerals, really enjoying it, you know. So fascinating poet.
There's a quote that really stood out for me was, "Don't have the veins bulging in your biro." And it's almost a step out of anger and political rage and, you know, stay true to yourself and what you want to convey to people and how you want to express yourself.
Don't have the veins bulging out of your biro. On that note, thank you, Seamus. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Poetry Pause. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And please tell your friends if they're poetry lovers too. See you soon.